Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
One of the questions the public continues to ask about Washington's response to Wall Street chaos is, what about me? Where's my bailout? Well, today the White House and the Fed chairman nudged the government closer to not exactly a bailout, but more money in your pocket. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. Sustainability reporting is supported by Johnson Controls, making homes, cars, and workplaces more comfortable, safe, and sustainable. Johnson Controls, where ingenuity is welcome.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Monday, the 20th day of October, for our ongoing look at the aftermath of the financial crisis. With the government handing out all kinds of money to banks and brokers and insurance companies, you'll be forgiven for wondering, where's mine? Well, it may be on the way. Today, both the Bush administration and Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke endorsed the idea of a second stimulus package, following up on the rebate checks many people got earlier this year. Of course, what they're hoping is that, unlike the banks, which are basically hoarding all that cash from the government, you'll go out and spend yours. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale tells us this injection into the economy could be as big or bigger than the $170 billion shot it got last spring.
After the election, Congress might push through a package of infrastructure improvements and unemployment benefits worth $150 billion or more. Bernanke told the House Budget Committee he's sensitive about more deficit spending.
All that being said, with the economy likely to be weak for several quarters and with some risk of a protracted slowdown, consideration of a fiscal package by the Congress at this juncture seems appropriate.
But committee member Paul Ryan, a Wisconsin Republican, doesn't think the government can afford another stimulus while it's running a $750 billion deficit.
That's before this kind of a stimulus package, which, with more government spending being shoveled out the door, at best would probably give us a little pop in GDP statistics, but not addressing the core problem, which is how do we grow the economy?
Ryan believes business tax breaks would be a better way to do that. But supporters of government spending say building schools and highways is a quicker jolt to the economy. Martin Bailey is a former White House economist who favors another stimulus package. He told the committee he is worried about deficits in the long run, but
I'm more concerned about making sure we get enough money out there quickly that we turn this economy around, because things are looking very ugly right now.
More deficit spending is a necessary risk, says Bailey, to put the economy back on its feet. And then options include raising taxes and trimming government spending to bring the deficit down. Still, it'll take years to pay it all back with interest. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
While Ben Bernanke was speaking on Capitol Hill, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson made his way to a different microphone to fill in details on that $250 billion plan to buy equity in some of the nation's largest banks. And he made clear it's not just the big guys who are invited to step up to the trough. Ashley Milne-Tite has more from New York.
In addition to the nine banks who announced their participation last week, we've received indications of interest from a broad group of banks of all sizes.
Secretary Paulson didn't specify how much money a bank has to have in reserve in order to join the capital infusion program. He said the Treasury's plan is to let any bank apply. Ben Wallace is a securities analyst with Grimes & Company. He says that should protect smaller banks.
If you come out and you give a specific number, you know, a certain capital ratio or what have you, then any bank that is at risk to fall below that or is right on the border of that could come under pressure.
If some banks were to be excluded from the scheme, they'd risk losing trading partners or depositors. That's exactly what the Treasury is trying to avoid. Still, Wallace says institutions wishing to participate face some hurdles.
Well, if a bank is in good condition, why do they need to participate in this? You know, it's the Groucho Marx who wouldn't want to be a member of a club that would have me as a member.
Paulson didn't address any of the risks of the program in his speech. Bart Notter is a banking analyst with consulting firm Celent. He says the secretary simply touted the benefits to taxpayers and left a lot of questions unanswered.
I think that the Treasury has to explain whether the purpose of this investment is to shore up weak banks and therefore experience a great deal of risk, or whether it is to get a return on the investment.
Nata says this plan obviously helps the banks, but it could leave ordinary Americans on the hook. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
This fiscal mess has been around long enough now that it has its own list of usual suspects, the businesses that have suffered either through their own making or by proxy, the real estate industry, investment bankers, retailers. But other sectors like technology and entertainment, the art market, they seemed to be faring okay, even talked about as recession-proof. Notice we put those sentences in past tense. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Conventional wisdom has it that some businesses have become immune to economic ups and downs. Take it from Tony Soprano.
What two businesses have traditionally been recession-proof since time immemorial?
Certain aspects of show business and our thing.
Well, no comment on Tony's business, but the movie business is taking a hit, says Porter Bibb with Media Tech Capital Partners.
They are typically considered recession-proof because movies are among the cheapest form of entertainment. But there's new competition now. You have DVDs, movies on demand on cable, and free downloads on the internet.
Many studios have said they'll make fewer movies. Paramount is reportedly putting two major films on ice to tighten budgets. And it's not just traditionally recession-proof businesses getting squeezed. Recession-proof people are too. After years of record profits, the art market looks poised to enter a red period. Syracuse University art economist Arthur Brooks says that's because the market relies on wealthy collectors.
Even people who are apparently recession-proof are having their net worth affected.
That goes for Silicon Valley, too. Venture capital is drying up and jobs are disappearing. Yahoo is expected to announce hundreds of layoffs when it reports earnings tomorrow. Jimmy Scheffler is an analyst with the Carmel Group.
The tech sector is about one-third full as opposed to two-thirds empty.
Scheffler says that's because a lot of technology has become an essential part of life, but he still predicts a very rough holiday season. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Deficits be damned. Wall Street apparently loves the idea of rebate checks as much as we do. The Dow rose 413 points today, about 4.5%, on word of more government spending to help the economy. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Wall Street may be a smoking ruin hosed down with gallons of cash from the Treasury Department, but elsewhere in the financial world, all they've needed is an eyedropper, if that. Local bank managers in places like Shreveport, Louisiana, say there's plenty of money to be had, and customers don't have to pay the kind of rates that the big banks are charging. Kate Archer-Kent of Red River Radio paid a visit to one local branch.
Harold Turner is president of Red River Bank, which has 14 branches in Louisiana. Lately, he's been getting stopped on the street by people asking, "Hey, Harold, are you still lending?"
Yeah, we have money to loan, and we're going to loan money like we have been. We're going to do it with people that we feel comfortable with, that can pay it back, that will sign on the note.
One person he feels comfortable with, Debbie Camus. She's a commercial real estate broker who recently borrowed $1 million to refurbish a building in downtown Shreveport. She shopped around for a competitive interest rate and found an existing relationship gave her the best deal.
I can go walk across the street and sit down in front of Harold face to face. So not only was he comfortable with our financial statements, but he's comfortable with us personally.
Camus had two things going for her, her relationship with Turner and her excellent credit rating. Turner says those are the cornerstones of the local banking business and the key to those banks' state of health.
What we're trying to do is meat and potatoes. It's pretty much basic banking based on principles that have been proven for a long, long time, where some of the larger banks, their business model requires them to do some things that is somewhat non-traditional.
He's talking about those credit swaps and derivative contracts you might have read about. Community banks like his steered away from that swamp of exotic securities. Now, unlike the big banks, they don't need to swallow the Treasury's $250 billion bailout, and they're still lending at reasonable rates.
The market is not going to allow us to be abusive on interest rates. If you think I'm charging you too much, talk to another bank. They'll loan you the money.
Turner is quite serious. Here in Shreveport, competition for customer deposits is intense. It's the same in small towns and cities right across the country. Ken Syrie is a banking professor at the University of Mississippi. He says community banks were wise to stick to servicing local businesses rather than go after big corporations that borrowed vast sums of money and are now running into trouble.
It's the really large customers who are having problems borrowing, like General Electric or General Motors. And small community banks don't have the capital by regulation and also from prudence to be able to lend to these very large businesses.
That strategy may have restricted their growth in the past, but Syrie says local lenders are smiling now. Deposits at community banks nationwide are rising. People have sold out of stocks and money market funds, and they're socking away their savings close to home. The upper levels of the financial system may look threatened, but Main Street banks are getting stronger. Good news for them and for the local businesses they lend to. In Shreveport, I'm Kate Archer-Kent for Marketplace.
One of the questions we're asking throughout the Wall Street meltdown is, what are you doing? Yes, you. And other people who are making decisions about how they save and invest. In this installment of the series, we check a financial pulse in Southern California.
I'm Dr. Tanish Walford. I'm a family medicine physician in Los Angeles, California. It's looking like I'll have to end up closing my practice that I've dedicated the last 5.5 years to build. I've watched revenues diminish because people can't and are not paying their bills. Probably last year this time, I had to refer maybe 2% of my patients to a collection agency to collect outstanding balances. Probably about 30% of my patients right now are in referred to a collection agency. And I don't like to put that kind of burden on them, but the flip side of that coin is that I can't pay my bills and I'm working for free. I'm going to pack up and abandon ship. I've decided to move back to the East Coast to an economy that is a little bit more user-friendly, so to speak. And I'm also going to hide behind the shield of a larger practice, probably hospital-based practice, that can fight with these insurance companies and the government to get proper reimbursement so I can survive. Not only to survive, but to flourish.
Dr. Tanish Walford practices family medicine here in Los Angeles. And now, let's do the numbers. Confidence made a comeback on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 4.75%, 413 points to close at 9,265. The NASDAQ added 3.4%, 58 points to end at 1770. And the S&P put on 4.75%, 44 points to finish the day at 985. Energy stocks really fueled the markets. The sector was up 11% today. Halliburton, the world's second largest oil field services provider, jumped 14% on higher than expected quarterly earnings. Exxon poured on 10% and NRG Energy surged 29% after Exelon offered to buy the second biggest electricity generator in Texas. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.85%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Missed anything from our special coverage of the fallout from America's financial crisis? You can listen to the entire show or get our After the Bell podcast, a weekly download of the business stories you need to know. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. The House Financial Services Committee holds a hearing on regulating credit default swaps. Brazil launches a fund to help protect the Amazon from deforestation. And the U.S.-Afghan trade fair continues with talks on energy and agriculture. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice gives a keynote address. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. The presidential candidates released their latest campaign money figures, and Democrat Barack Obama shattered fundraising records once again. The sum total of his haul, $150 million in September. Republican nominee John McCain is limited to the $84 million in public financing he accepted after the convention. Ken Vogel writes for Politico.com, and we've asked him to evaluate what all this means for campaign financing in general. Welcome to the program.
Hey, great to be with you, Tess.
So how surprising is this number, $150 million in 1 month?
Yeah, it's pretty shocking. There's no real precedent in campaign finance history. First of all, there's no precedent for anyone in the modern era actually turning down the public financing grant. So
right.
When Obama did that, a lot of folks were kind of wondering, hey, is this going to be a good decision? There's certainly a lot of risk here. This proves this was a great decision.
What does this say for the future of public financing? I mean, is it dead at this point, given that you can raise so much money outside of the system?
It's on life support. I don't think it's dead yet because I don't think there are too many candidates who have this kind of fundraising ability, not just the ability to tap small donors, but to tap such a wide network of small donors almost without lifting a finger. Sure, he has his web team out there, but he's not working the rubber chicken circuit. He's not taking a whole lot of time off of the campaign trail to go raise money. There aren't too many candidates about whom you could say that.
I think one of the big criticisms of the public financing program is that it's just not real. $84 million for the presidential campaign just sounds like it's not a lot of money. Do you think we'll be seeing adjustments to that figure, or will we potentially see a wholesale overhaul of the public financing system?
I think we'll see efforts to do both. And certainly there have been efforts to do both in previous years, including some sponsored by John McCain and Barack Obama. But there just hasn't been a whole lot of appetite. Folks who fill out their tax form have the option of checking off that $3 box to donate money. A lot of folks don't check it, including Sarah Palin, including Barack Obama on the first four set of taxes that he provided for 2007 to members of the media. He subsequently provided additional form that did show that he checked that box. But even if they were to increase the set aside so that, say, you could check off for $5, questions about whether folks would actually check the box.
There have been so many efforts to reform this system, and none of it really seems to get the job done. Is there anything that could get the job done?
Well, short of a major scandal, I don't think that there is a whole lot. Let's not forget that both of these candidates coming in actually were known as campaign finance reformers. This is not an issue that is tremendously popular with the American people. It's kind of a wonky issue. So the fact that we actually had two campaign finance reformers, you know, win their party's nomination, and yet still we see this dissolution of the very framework that come to think of as kind of undergirding the campaign finance system, I think is pretty telling.
Ken Vogel of Politico.com, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you.
Wall Street's losses aren't just reflected in share values. The state of New York expects some 40,000 financial sector jobs will be lost because of the crisis. As part of our election series, Interested Parties, Jeremy Hobson caught up with some ex-Wall Streeters to find out what they're expecting from the next administration.
So this was your building here, 1 State Street Plaza?
Yep.
And you used to come here every day?
Every single day, yep.
Brian Tackett is 28. Until recently, he worked for a mid-sized insurance broker in New York's financial district.
You know, we dealt with these private equity and alternative investment folks that were piggybacking off of mortgage-backed securities and collateralized debt obligations and whatnot to fund their ventures. And now that that's no longer there, there's no need for me to be looking at the deals and, you know, evaluating the insurance. So, yeah, I mean, I would say 100% I'm a direct casualty of you know, what's going on in the financial markets right now.
We walk a few blocks away to Battery Park. Thousands of financial employees come here in the middle of their workday to snack, walk, or just sit, facing the nearby Statue of Liberty. Tackett says he places much of the blame on greed in the private sector. But, he says,
government regulation would have been at least a way to take care of the problem. I think that the other thing is that, you know, there wasn't any, there were no ethics involved from the private sector. I mean, I think these guys saw the dollar signs and they continued to just do what they were going to do because they knew they weren't going to lose any money, or at least that's what they thought.
We're coming up on the presidential election. Is this going to figure into how you vote?
Absolutely. But I think, you know, looking at everybody else, who's the better candidate to help take care of everybody and not just me?
Tackett wants the next president to have a better grasp of the financial services industry so he can do a better job of regulating it. So does 46-year-old Christopher Miraldi. I caught up with him in Central Park. He spent 20 years in the business, most recently selling Wachovia's financial products to international clients. He was laid off in February.
What did they tell you?
Basically that, you know, the bank, there were losses, and that my job was being eliminated. I asked twice if it was performance related, and they said no.
Miraldi will be fine for the moment. He started saving his bonuses a couple years ago and says he could live for months without working. But he says Washington needs to get its priorities straight.
The government really needs to look at the banking system as a critical industry. What would it be like if we had no regulation in meat and poultry? The market would not regulate itself. You would have garbage on your shelves. Why do they think it's going to be any different with banking?
Do you think that Washington can create the kinds of regulations that Wall Street types won't be able to just get around?
You know, Wall Street's very clever. I think that they can always get around things. But I think someone who understands the industry will create the proper regulations.
Miraldi isn't just thinking about regulation of the industry he once worked in. He's got a new concern. When he lost his job, he lost his health care.
Having health care tied to your job is absolutely ludicrous, because at precisely the moment when you do get downsized, all of a sudden your health care costs jump through the roof with COBRA.
Perhaps most of all, though, he says, he just wants the next president to be straight with the American people.
We can take bad news. We're not going to fall apart. Telling people, you know, sugarcoating things is not really going to help, because then they get angry. And when you're angry, you can't think logically.
Both of these ex-Wall Streeters are holding out hope for jobs. Brian Tackett is networking and sending out resumes. Christopher Miraldi is thinking about regulating the industry he once worked for. He's also considering getting out of the business altogether, teaching English abroad. Both Tackett and Miraldi plan to vote next month. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Over the weekend, details emerged from an interview that Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao did with Science magazine last month. He said his government shared responsibility for the tainted milk incident in China that killed 4 infants and sickened thousands. Melamine, a chemical in plastic, was being used in various dairy products. Unfortunately, the adulteration of food isn't new. Author B. Wilson writes about the history of what she calls food fraud in her new book, Swindled. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
When you read about something like the milk scandal in China, you kind of can't help but ask yourself, why would anyone intentionally put harmful stuff in food, especially food that's being given to kids?
This is the sort of thing which you see happening a lot where there are very low economic margins. Obviously, you've also got to have a society, as with modern day China, where you've got the opportunities for swindling. And unfortunately, they haven't yet got the kind of regulatory system in place which prevents it from happening. And the really scandalous thing as well about the current dairy scandal in China is that it's following hot on the heels of a previous scandal, which I write about in my book, from 2004, where there was a whole industry of people making fake infant formula from pretty much nothing but sugar and starch. And this wasn't just a few bad apples, you know, just a few rogue individuals who happened to be evil doing it. It was being made in 141 different factories in China.
Well, we're talking here about situations in 2008 and in 2004, but as you point out, food fraud has been going on really throughout the ages. What's one of the more egregious examples in the last, say, 100 years or so?
One that really recalls the current China scandal is the Swill milk scandal that was happening in New York and San Francisco and Chicago and plenty of other American cities in the 1850s, 1860s. People were keeping cows in stables attached to distilleries. And instead of feeding them something wholesome like grass, they were feeding them the leftover hot alcoholic mash made from making liquor. So effectively, we're talking about alcoholic cows who are producing alcoholic milk, which is again being marketed for children.
Well, when did officials kind of finally start paying attention to what was going in food that was being manufactured?
It took a long time. It takes a whole culture shift for these things to change. And it took a lot more scandals. I mean, one of the most famous examples, which a lot of people will have read in high school, is Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle.
Right.
Which really led to the Pure Food and Drugs Act of 1906, which was the first proper federal law addressing the problem over the whole of the states.
Well, I have to ask you, how do you go out to dinner? How do you go to the grocery store and trust that what you're getting there is safe?
I think there's kind of two issues. There's the big cultural political issues. There's a point where, you know, this is not something that individuals can protect themselves against. So we need better government regulation. And as for what you can do as an individual in the grocery store, well, I think so much of it is really common sense. I think if we can reacquaint ourselves with the ingredients that go into good food, then you'll know when you're being served a fake. The best protection, really, against swindling is knowing the real thing.
B. Wilson is the author of Swindled, The Dark History of Food Fraud from Poisoned Candy to Counterfeit Coffee. Thanks so much for joining us and for killing my appetite.
Thank you. I'm sorry about that.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $8 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, if you're looking for a bit of good news in this financial turmoil, look no further than the pump. AAA says the national average for a gallon of gas hit $2.92. That's down 10 cents just from Friday. Prices are down 29% from the record highs in July. Meanwhile, a barrel of oil is down more than 50% in that same time period. And that's a Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 413 points, 4 2/3%. The Nasdaq added 58 points, 3 4/10%. The S&P 500 gained 44 points, 4 3/4%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Join us tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report for more of Fallout, our coverage of the financial crisis. Next time on Marketplace, tallying up Lehman Brothers credit default swaps.
On any given day in the global payment system, banks are moving trillions of dollars, on average at least $5 trillion every day.
Yeah, so what's another $6 billion, right? I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you'll join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.